Good afternoon. Thank you all for being with us today. I'm Steve Morrison of CSIS, and I just want to welcome you all here this afternoon. This is a first major collaborative event that we're hosting here at CSIS with the International AIDS Society, and we're really thrilled and honored that we can begin this partnership. It's not the first time we've done things together with IAS, but the relationship has sort of entered a new phase, and Ron McGinnis from IAS is now with us here at CSIS, and we've been planning a number of different things that you'll be seeing over the course of the next couple of years, and this is one of them. And so really it's a terrific partnership. It's one that earlier helped us do some very important work, I believe, here on the particularly focused on lifting the entry ban on persons living with HIV. There's a lot of excitement here in this town now that the ban has been lifted and it becomes possible to come back to Washington, D.C. In 2012 with the International AIDS Conference. And I know there's a stakeholder meeting later in the day here around that. I'm going to turn the floor over to the Executive Director of IAS, Robin Gorna, in a minute to do the introductions for Dr. Fauci. We're going to have a speech from Tony, have some discussion, and then we'll move to a roundtable after that that will carry us up until the conclusion at 3 p.m. So on behalf of everyone at CSIS, thank you all for coming. And Robin, please.
Thank you very much, Stephen. And I really want to just, on behalf of the IAS, thank the Center for Strategic Information Studies. No, I got that wrong already. Brilliant. Center for Strategic and International Studies, or as Julio Montana likes to think of it, as the Canadian Secret Service, for hosting Ron and really for building this really important relationship between ourselves. The IAS is absolutely thrilled to have this stronger relationship, so thank you. And I do hope that today is the first of many engagements, and I won't mess up on the name ever again. My pleasure today is to introduce the man that doesn't need introducing. So thank you very much, Dr. Tony Fauci, for agreeing to do this talk for us here today. This comes in the sequence of activities that began with the Vancouver Summit that the IAS hosted in February of this year. And I think this is a really important opportunity to take stock. I don't need to introduce Tony Fauci to you, but just let me remind you about the seminal contributions he has made to the field of HIV and AIDS. He's really led so much of the understanding about how the AIDS virus destroys the body's defenses. He's also delineated the mechanisms of induction of HIV expression by endogenous cytokines. He's been instrumental in developing highly effective strategies for the therapy of people with HIV, as well as work on the vaccine. He contributes so much of his research time to identifying the nature of the immunopathogenic mechanisms of HIV infection and the issue around immune responses and AIDS in reservoirs. As you know, since 1984, Dr. Fauci has been the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases at the NIH, and he oversees an extensive research portfolio of basic and applied research. He's also a key advisor to the White House and the Department of Health and Human Services on global AIDS issues. And I think one of the remarkable things about Dr. Fauci is that I think he's very much one of the first researchers to really engage so strongly in the policy dialogue and also with the activist community. So from the beginning of his career, we've really seen him spanning that question of science and evidence into policy and working across the broad range of communities. It's my real honor to introduce you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Robin and Steve. It's a great pleasure to be here with you this afternoon on this merging of interest and collaboration between the IAS and CSIS. It's really a pleasure to be part of this process, and I look forward to continuing working with you both over the years to come. I'm going to talk a bit, just as an introduction, to introduce the, hopefully, and I know it will be a fruitful discussion as we get the panel going, with an update fundamentally about therapy and prevention, about where we are, where we've been, and where we hope to be. And I'll do that as rapidly as I possibly can before one does that, I think we need to put into perspective something that virtually everyone in this room already knows, and that is the extent of the problem that we're dealing with. The most recent numbers, as you know, came out just last month from UNAIDS, confirming with an even more accurate determination the extraordinary numbers that we're dealing with 33.4 million people living with HIV, continuing to have 2.7 million new infections each year with 2 million deaths. The numbers, however, are even more stark when you look at the people that are getting infected. If you analyze it a different way from the data that we've gotten from last month, there are about 7,500 HIV infections per day worldwide in 2008, despite the ability, and I'll get into in a moment, of well-proven prevention modalities. Greater than 95% of the infections are in low and middle income countries, and we all know that 2/3 of these are in Southern Africa, 1,200 among children under 15 years of age, 6,200 among adults age 15 and older, and about a 50-50 between women and men, with women having a slightly greater percentage of infection globally. So the numbers quantitatively are terrible. When you look at the people that are getting infected, it really is the fruit of the youth of the world. You're sitting right here, for those of you who don't live here, in Washington, D.C., and we have the worst problem in the United States of America right here in this city, with 3% of the entire population of the District of Columbia infected and 6.5% of African American men who live in the District of Columbia are infected with HIV, which if you compare that to Southern African countries, we would rank right up there with some of the worst of the countries. Again, a testimony to the fact that the accessibility to the kinds of things that would help prevent HIV infection is something that is challenging us now and will continue to challenge us for the next few years. So with that as a very brief introduction, I'm going to talk very briefly about the three aspects of the advances in HIV/AIDS research from the beginning in 1981 through the current time now in 2009 in the arena of treatment prevention, and then a word about vaccine development. The fundamental basic research that went into HIV/AIDS very early on in the early years following the discovery and the relationship between HIV as the causative agent for HIV/AIDS has been the source of targets for the development of drugs along the line that is unprecedented in the history of the relationship between fundamental basic research, targeted drug development, and products, which have really transformed a disease as wide-ranging and extraordinary as HIV. As you see from this particular simplified slide of the replication cycle of HIV and the antiretroviral drugs that have targeted various vulnerable components of this, leading to, again, one of the most extraordinary accomplishments, I can say this without hyperbole, I think in the history of biomedical research, where you have now about 30 drugs, more than 30, that have been approved by the US FDA, either alone or in combination, that have literally transformed the lives of HIV-infected individuals. And in fact, I've had, as some in the room have, the personal experience of being there right from the very beginning and having to take care of patients in my hospital just 5 miles north of here in Bethesda, when we began admitting large numbers of individuals in the summer of 1981 with what turned out to be HIV infection, but we did not know what it was, so therefore we could not treat it. And if you look at the early years prior to HART, which I've described in various writings and discussions as the dark ages of the HIV historic perspective, it certainly was the darkest period in my personal history as a physician and a physician scientist, because virtually every single one of the patients that I took care of either died as I was taking care of them or after they went out in the hospital and died in hospices and at their own home. This gradually changed as we had monotherapy, then dual therapy, and then the issues that we are now facing with, where we have extraordinary success in blocking HIV replication to the point that we've transformed the lives of people who have this accessible to them. And in fact, there have been a number of studies, and this one, I have the opportunity, the privilege of testifying a lot of times a year in front of the Congress for the budget for HIV/AIDS. And every time we talk about Because when you get to in front of the Congress, the question they always ask you is, what have you done for me lately? Which is a reasonable question when you're dealing with billions of dollars of taxpayer money. So what we've been done is lately, I think, is the success story that continues to drive the support of this, is that if you look at way back, the first patients that I admitted in the summer of 1981 to our ward in Bethesda, the mean time of survival from the time they came in to see me, because they would only come in if they were already very ill, because you had to have an AIDS-defining illness so you didn't know that you were infected with whatever it was that you were infected with, we didn't know at the time, was 26 weeks of survival. So right now, if you do a simple mathematical model and somebody walks into the clinic up the road who's 20 years old and recently infected, you could project that that person, if they get started on an antiretroviral therapy, would live to at least 69 years old. So I don't think there's a therapeutic success story that's any better than that. This has been made available not only to people in the developed world, but to people in low and middle income countries through a number of programs that everyone in this room, I believe, is familiar with. Probably the most important of which is the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR, which started off as a 5-year, $15 billion program. Also, the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria, and a variety of philanthropies like the Gates Foundation, the Clinton Foundation, MSF, and others. Again, if you look at the accelerated number of individuals who are on therapy now, when I first went to Africa, as drugs became available for the United States, and there was no drugs in Southern Africa, and then only in those countries in which people can afford it, which was very few, there were literally tens of thousands of people on therapy. Now we have about 4 million people are receiving therapy. That is the good news. 1.2 million lives have projected to have been saved over a 3-year period from 2004 to from 2007 by PEPFAR alone. And when you add PEPFAR plus the other sources of drugs for the developing world, it is felt that about 2.9 million lives have been saved, and 11.7 million life years were added globally between 1996. And 1996, as you know, was a banner year because that's when combination therapies were first proven to actually be able to greatly extend the lifespan of individuals if you made that therapy available to them. Now, there is growing evidence that antiretroviral therapy should be initiated earlier in the course of HIV disease. So that's a good news in many respects, but it provides for us an extraordinary challenge. The reason is that by what we have currently, as you well know, that about 40% of the individuals who would need therapy, and I'll get to that in a moment, are receiving therapy, which means that 60% are not. So if you look at the data, which is very exciting data, despite the fact that it puts before us extraordinary challenges, we know, if you look at the history, and I don't have it now, but I have a slide, the history of how we have changed our thinking. First, you only treat people who have AIDS-defining illness. Then you look at the CD4 count as a surrogate marker, less than 200. We are learning now, the more we look, it started off with the SMART study when it became clear that the deleterious events that occur are less related to the drugs that you give than are related to the presence of viremia. And now, as you know, there's pretty good data, very good data, that if you treat an individual from 350 to 500 CD4 cells, it's much better than waiting until they drop below the levels that had been the previous recommendations. And even greater than 500, we're seeing that. Not only in individual studies like the Kitahara study, but also if you look at a number of cohort studies that have been looked together in a broader analysis, the same thing holds true. The earlier vis-a-vis the CD4 count, the better. In fact, the question that people ask, well, this maybe applies to the developed world. Will it really apply to the developing world? And we again are starting to have studies, this one from Haiti, in which the same positive effect of earlier treatment compared to waiting was shown in the situation in Haiti, which clearly reflects the situation in the developing world in African, Southern African countries. So now we have new U.S. and WHO guidelines for early antiviral therapy. You know, the United States HHS panel just recently came out with the recommendations that you treat anything less than 350. You recommend treatment from 350 to 500, and the panel was evenly divided, and it was said it could either be recommended or optional for greater than 500. So that's a real big change from previous. As you know, the WHO, the month before, came out with a recommendation that less than 350 should be the time that you should start. Some other recommendations, such as phasing out D4T and treating earlier in pregnancy and during the breastfeeding period. Now, if you look at the ARV coverage in low and middle income countries, as I mentioned, about 40% of the people who need it, according to the less than 200 guidelines, are receiving antiretroviral therapy. If you change the guideline, as it has been, to less than 350, then only about 30% of these individuals will be receiving therapy, and you will add another few million people who need therapy. So the challenges that we're facing with limited resources is something that we're going to have to carefully examine over the next several years. So if you have increased global HIV prevalence, more individuals requiring antiretroviral therapy, is this an insurmountable challenge, or are we going to have to rise to the occasion to address that? And I think you know what the answer is. It is not insurmountable, and we really do need. So what is the way forward? Obviously, scaling up the delivery of proven interventions in the most cost-effective manner as possible. And I know we're going to get a chance to discuss that during the panel period. The other is a cure in the sense of either eliminating the virus or getting the person to the point where you could stop therapy, even though there is detectable virus, and that person can get along without therapy? And what about new tools of prevention? The major obstacles, as we all know, to a cure for HIV disease is that the very nature of this extraordinary virus, it hides from the immune system, it forms a latent reservoir, and it doesn't express itself in that latent reservoir, letting drug-induced suppression as well as immunological surveillance be very difficult to accomplish. When you think about cure, you think about eradication, which is very unlikely that we'll have a sterilizing cure, but not impossible. And we are putting a considerable amount of resources into looking at ways that you could silence the expression of HIV in cells that are lately infected. If the cell is actively producing, then the standard antiretroviral drugs will work against them. But you've got to get the cells that are containing virus that are not expressing it. The other is the timing of when you start therapy. Namely, can you preserve enough of the immune system such that when you stop therapy, you can actually prevent certain segment of the population? I don't think you're going to get everyone that's going to be that way, but at least a certain proportion of individuals where you can discontinue drug. The third part of that limb that I mentioned on the previous slide is prevention. So the good news, I don't have time to go over every one of these, but the good news is we have a lot of proven prevention modalities that we know work. We don't suppose that they work. We know that they work. And they're listed here on this slide, and I know you're familiar with them, so I won't go through them individually. This is one of them, though, that's very dramatic. If you look at prevention of mother-to-child transmission and look at the number of accumulative infections that have been averted by the institution and implementation of antiretroviral prophylaxis to HIV-positive pregnant women, it is extraordinary and dramatic, as shown on this slide. The same holds true for other proven modalities. Good news. Sobering news, less than one person in five, or less than 20% of people who are at risk for HIV infection have access to basic HIV prevention services. That's proven. What about the pipeline? Some things that are rather bold. Things that we're looking at right now. One of them, as you know, is topical microbicides. And we had the rather discouraging news today and yesterday that the Pro 2000, that was a hint of some efficacy on the preliminary trial, now that the thousands of patients' data came out, there's no effect at all. Now remember, there isn't an antiretroviral in that particular preparation. And we've said this from the very beginning, that the greater chance you have of a microbicide working is if you have a specific antiretroviral in the compound itself. And there are a number of clinical trials that are going on. Pre-exposure prophylaxis, again, in principle, it should work. Can it be implemented? And another test and treat strategy, which is a very, very bold approach towards mathematically modeling, if you get everyone tested and treat a certain percentage of individuals, you can actually lower the mean viral load in the community to the point where there would be less of a transmission. And then vaccines. Just a word on the test and treat phenomenon. Carl Diefenbach, my colleague, and I wrote a commentary in JAMA just this past summer about a number of research issues that will have to be addressed if this, in fact, could even be imagined to be implemented. But I want to just throw out to this audience that if you test widely and treat, and the formula works, which many people think won't, in the fact you'd have to treat so many people, access so many people, that you could then, by that alone, get the R0 of the virus to be less than one, and therefore the epidemic will go away by itself. Even if you don't attain that, the idea that you can actually get the rate of transmission down and supplement that with microbicide, a reasonably effective vaccine, I think we could see synergy between those two. So I don't think it should be thought of as an all or none phenomenon. I'm going to close in the last couple of minutes on vaccine. Again, as I say every time I talk about vaccine, we started off in a very difficult position with HIV vaccines. I've been developing with my colleagues for now over 2.5 decades vaccines for a variety of diseases. And although it's a difficult process, the roadmap for it is shown to you by the body's own response to the particular virus or microbe in question. So be it historically smallpox and polio, or recently things like hepatitis, when you get infected with a particular virus, takes viruses for example, although there's morbidity and mortality to a varying degree, invariably the body responds, suppresses the virus, eradicates the virus, and leaves you with lasting, usually lifelong immunity to reinfection. That's the reason why we have vaccines, because all you have to do is follow what the virus does. Not so with HIV, since for reasons that we're still trying to sort out, the body does not respond adequately in a protective way against HIV. So you don't have a proof of concept. So we've had to do some very interesting things, starting off empirically, and then now going back and looking at some fundamental questions. You're all aware that there was the first glimmer of encouraging results from the Thai trial that was examined and discussed in great detail at the vaccine meeting in October in Paris. Again, 30% efficacy. One of the determinations, the modified intent to treat, showed significance. And these are the three curves, the Kaplan-Meier curves of both the intent to treat, the modified intent to treat, and the per protocol. And although it was a very slight to modest effect, what will be looked at right now, and there's some very interesting things about that, there was an effect on acquisition, but there was no effect on the control of viral replication. Now, some people said, that goes to show you it's probably a fluke, because if it was blocking acquisition, it should definitely block virus replication. I completely disagree with that, because what I think, and many people think, and it's not any great, brilliant, creative thought, is that the mechanisms that block acquisition might be very, very different from the mechanisms that block very, very robust virus replication. So although there was no effect of the placebo versus the vaccine in virus replication, you can imagine a scenario, and there are animal models that are showing that now, that there's a qualitative difference between the immune response that's involved in blocking acquisition versus the immune response in controlling chronic virus replication. And I think the reason is that the virus is different. The transmitting virus has some very peculiar characteristics that are different in many respects qualitatively from the virus that's been replicating for 2 or 3 years in an individual. All of these things we're going to have to examine very carefully. So the way forward in vaccinology is we have a model. It's only slightly to modestly effective. We need to determine what the mechanisms of immune protection are. We need to maximize the induction of the immune response that was seen in subsequent vaccine candidates. The idea of aiming only to block virus replication, I think, is something that we really need to realistically look at as not the end game for anything. So we need to try and block acquisition as the primary goal of a vaccine. We need to develop relevant models in the non-human primate and pursue the differences I suggested between the transmitting virus and the chronically replicating virus, and to do this with an appropriate balance between empiric and clinical research. Having said that, if we get a vaccine and when we get a vaccine, I used to say if, but I actually say when now, because I really do think that we are going to have some degree of, I don't know whether that's going to be 50%, 60%, I get asked that every day. I don't know what the number's going to be, but it's going to be better than 30. It has to be better than 30 because we don't accept 30. But the real issue is that even if you get a vaccine of a relatively high percentage effectiveness, it's never going to be a freestanding preventive modality the way we have with polio or with smallpox or with hepatitis. It has to be incorporated into a comprehensive HIV prevention modality. So having said that, I want to close on this last slide. I have emphasized many of the extraordinary accomplishments that we have been witness to and participated in over the last 28 years since we first recognized this extraordinary pandemic that was thrust upon us. But I think we can say with all realism that we have much, much more to do than we've accomplished. So if we've accomplished an awful lot, we have an extraordinary challenge awaiting us for the future. And I hope that we get a chance to discuss this as we get through the panel. Thank you.
Dr. Fauci, would you mind taking a few questions?
Sure, no, I'd
be happy to. And we'll do that for a few minutes,
sure.
And then we'll move to the
bathroom. Sure, be delighted to. Happy to.
Dr. Fauci, question. I'm Joel Gay, a consultant with OSI and also a non-scientist member of the NIAID IRB. And my question is, the WHO guidelines that were just released call for heart for women through pregnant women through the end of breastfeeding, but then sort of don't go on from there. And if a woman doesn't continue with heart at the end of breastfeeding, would this not be injurious for her health?
Well, I'm going to word the question differently because I'm pretty good at not getting misquoted. So... in the ideal world, if some, what's going to happen, that's almost going to be negated because the vast, vast majority of the people that you identify as HIV infected with the new guidelines of 350 or less and then even pushing it between 350 and 500 are going to, on their own right, need to be on therapy. Dissociated with them from the fact that they're pregnant women. So the way I look at it is that if somebody falls into that category, which is going to get 98% of the breastfeeding women, they should be on therapy. So I'm not going to address the WHO guidelines. I'm going to give you my impression of who should be on therapy.
Hi, I'm Erin Holfelder from the Sabin Vaccine Institute, and because we work on neglected tropical diseases, you know, we're thrilled to see parasitic infections included in the pipeline in your presentation, but the indications we've been getting from PEPFAR is that they're concerned about mission creep and expanding PEPFAR's portfolio. So in terms of realistic funding streams, how much expansion do you see PEPFAR doing, particularly when it comes to these sort of innovative prevention methods?
Well, as you probably know, if you listen to how the programs are being articulated by Eric Goosby and by the State Department and by the administration, is that they are striving right now to create a much more comprehensive approach towards global health, of which PEPFAR is a major, major pillar. So rather than say PEPFAR should be responsible for NTDs, it should be that the Global Health Initiative should include NTDs. And now, obviously, when you have a limited amount of resources, it's tough to do that. And we're in a tough situation. Anybody that denies that we're in a tough situation when you have limited funding for a potential to do so much good if we had more funding. But given what we have, the fundamental philosophy is a good one, is to make it a more comprehensive approach. And clearly PEPFAR, which is HIV, AIDS, TB, and malaria in there, is something that is indispensable to the Global Health Initiative. But NTDs, I mean, there is an NTD initiative. I know because I helped write it. So, I mean, it's there, and it's not going to just fall between the cracks. The trouble we're all facing now is how are we going to get enough resources to fully fund everything that needs to be funded? And that's, I don't have the answer for that right now. Yes?
My name is Justin Mandala. I work for Family Health International. Thank you very much for this excellent presentation. I wanted to know if there's any reason why you didn't mention anything about strengthening the health system. Because I think, for instance, with the new guidelines now, with a lot of emphasis on CD4 count, there are very few health systems that have capacity today to check CD4 count. Just to give you an example, in Zambia, with FHI support, we're trying to check CD4 count among women, pregnant women. For 90% of them, it was not possible to do that. Mm-hmm. Although we had all the treatment we needed for women that needed art and so on. So if we don't talk about it now, right, who is going to talk about it?
Well, now you make a good point. I didn't deliberately not talk about it because Steve asked me to talk about an update on treatment and prevention. But let me talk about it now so that'll not only be the right thing to do but may make you feel better. So if you look at what's evolving with the Global Health Initiative and you read carefully the information that's coming out of that, sustainable health systems are a part of that. They're clearly a part of that. And I think you're going to start to see that that's the way the programs are going to evolve. Because I have been saying, and we've all been saying, right from the very beginning of PEPFAR and anything else that we're doing in global health initiatives, that unless you have a sustainable system, you're going nowhere. And in fact, PEPFAR in the early years contributed greatly to some of those health systems. So you want to be explicit about it and not sort of have it happen as an accident. And I agree with you. And I think that that's what we're going to see as the Global Health Initiative matures, that you can't have a good Global Health Initiative without addressing health systems. So I agree with you. That's a very good point. Yeah.
Alan Moore with the Stimson Center. Two questions, Tony. One on prevention, one on treatment. The prevention question, I didn't see any reference to behavioral change. I know you know a lot about that and the importance of delayed onset and fewer concurrent partners. So I'll give you a chance to add a word about that subject. Secondly, on treatment, in light of the fact that there aren't enough resources and in light of the fact that we've got a new WHO guideline, what kind of guidance can you give to a country that's trying to decide with finite resources whether to move to the sickest people, under 200, or to the not-so-sick? And in a world of scarce resources, is it obvious which direction you'd want to turn? Well, that vary country to country. Just love to have your comment on that.
Yeah, I want to show you my... Okay. So, I put it in as the third bullet. I didn't mention it explicitly, so I don't want you to get upset with me. It's there. It's there. Okay. So that's the answer to that. Of course, it's very, very important. Those are proven. Those are things that we really need to address. So I we have a whole institute that gets involved with that at NIH. The issue that you asked about decision, that to me, I don't have the answer to that. I mean, that's a Sophie's Choice decision. You obviously can't stop therapy in someone who you started therapy on. I mean, to me, you just can't do that. You obviously you're driven to starting therapy in people who are falling into the already established guidelines of needing therapy. And now that we've changed them, we've made it, I say better, but actually even worse. I can't give you a Sophie's Choice answer. I don't know. It's going to have to be each individual country deciding how they're going to do that. The default position would likely be not to start people anew on therapy and to keep people who are on therapy on therapy. Because, you know, if you stop it, you're in some serious trouble. But I can't make a recommendation. Each country is going to have to look at it. You know, I really do hope, we were just talking inside about what we need to do to get enough resources so that doesn't happen. And I think we need to engage a lot more countries than the G8 and just get not only host countries, but also expand the G20 and beyond to take a look at the responsibility that the developed world has to the developing world about that. It just seems unconscionable that we'd come to that situation, but we might. Yeah.
Thanks very much, Dr. Fauci. My name is Janet Fleischman with the Global Health Policy Center. And I don't see in your list of prevention strategies a reference to family planning, both broadly but in particular for HIV-positive women, and I wonder if you could address that.
All right, I'll put that bullet in next time. Thank you. I will.
Why don't we go ahead and transition to the round?
Okay, great.
Please join me in thanking Dr. Fauci. We're moving. So let me quickly introduce our other panelists here. To my left is Phil Nyberg, known to many of you. He's a senior associate here at CSIS after a long and distinguished career at CDC. He's a pediatrician and infectious disease expert. He began working on HIV and TB back in 91. And in 96, when the National Center on HIV, STD, and TB Prevention was established, was the deputy senior, the associate director for science there in that newly established center. He was the lead author on the piece that we did on the lift of the test ban, and on the entry ban, and has also been very instrumental in the paper that we've just issued on prevention. And so I'm hoping we'll hear more from him, drawing from that work that began in the course of this summer. Diane Havler, to my left, is a professor of medicine at University of California, San Francisco, chief of the HIV/AIDS division there. She is the regional representative on the governing council of the International AIDS Society, and has just been made the U.S. co-chair for the AIDS 2012 conference that will be held here in Washington, 2012. She's very active on the WHO ARV treatment guideline working group, as well as in the TB partnership as chair of the HIV and TB working group. Eli Katabira is known to many of you. He's a professor of medicine at Makerere University. He's had, for the last 25 years, been very instrumental in developing treatment and management guidelines for HIV/AIDS. And he is the president-elect for the International AIDS Society and the international chair for the AIDS 2012 gathering here in Washington. He's also co-founder of the AIDS support organization, TASO, that's known to many of us, and has been very active in IAS, is co-editor of the IAS Journal, among other things. So let me just open by, I'd like to move for a moment to the dilemma that Dr. Fauci sort of put before us, which is we seem to be entering a phase here where the demand side of the equation has expanded fairly significantly, and it potentially pits those who are very ill against those who are not very ill in a way. We have a relatively flat base of financing globally that is there, and there needs to be a search and a lot of contemplation on how that can be enlarged. And we are also in a phase in which, within our own government, we are moving towards a broadened approach, which has its own complications in terms of strategy and trade-offs and the like. And I think this is something that we will be talking about a lot here in Washington and elsewhere. It's not just an American issue, it's a global issue. But here, where we have been the major funder for HIV, and where we're facing rather catastrophic national debt and deficit levels as we head into the next year, these questions of funding streams, how do you preserve a growth trajectory in your funding streams? How do you preserve the confidence of Congress, particularly on a bipartisan basis, when that partisanship has frayed? These are all issues that are very much in front of us, along with the tensions that continue to be with us around prevention versus treatment. So perhaps I could turn to Diane to talk for just a moment as to how you see this emerging challenge, and how do you begin to frame the issues as a way that you can get people to think very constructively and positively looking forward.
I think one of the things for us to think about in framing the situation we face is that the PEPFAR program and the benefits of scaling up antiretroviral therapy and having prevention messages have impacted many different diseases. And TB is one area I would really like to mention in that particular regard. In places most hit with the HIV epidemic, they also have overlapping epidemics of TB. And the leading cause of death of HIV-infected persons actually is tuberculosis. So if you look at if you just put your TB head on, so we're talking about different constituencies wanting to get funding, they are on the way to meet the MDG goals if it were not for HIV, because HIV-infected individuals are at increased susceptibility to TB. Well, we do have a response to that. When we think about what are we getting from, Tony talked about how the congressman wanted to know, what have you gotten for us? Well, one of the things we've gotten with the AIDS rollout programs is a reduction in TB rates. We're seeing it at the community level now across all populations, and there's even been modeling, just as Julio would talk about with treatment for prevention, that scaling up antiretroviral therapy reduces TB rates. So there are many examples of interventions that we're doing that are cross-cutting diseases that we need to be telling people about in terms of what the investment can do.
Thank you. Ellie, what is your thoughts on how we should be thinking, looking forward, about this broad emerging dilemma that we face?
Well, it's a difficult one. Of course, we as recipients, we see things differently. Many of our part of the world have put a lot of confidence in countries which have been providing us support. And also, we are very much aware of the financial dilemmas which we are having. And as Tony has mentioned, WHO has even made it worse for us, because there are very few countries, except maybe Botswana, which have achieved more than 80% in treating those who require antiretroviral therapy. Many countries are hovering around 50, 60, 70. Now even Botswana did that because they had even raised their CD4 level to 250 from 200. Mm-hmm. But now many of them have been working around 200. Now you put it at 350, even that's going to be difficult. The question is, how do we go about it? Of course, as Tony said and others, the involvement not only of US but also of other countries, the G8 mm-hmm. and G20, is very useful. But also, I think more importantly, even our own countries need to reevaluate our strategies mm-hmm. for providing care for our HIV-infected patients. I personally believe that there is a lot we can do ourselves to complement what we get from other support. And best way to get that moving is mainly getting countries with the leadership quality like US and other G8 countries to help us or to push us a little more so that we provide more for our own patients. Definitely with the PEPFAR and others, we've made a long way in improving our health systems. I know somebody just said that it's not possible to do CD4 cell count to everybody. That's probably true, but it's now not as true as it was 5 years ago, mainly because two things have happened. The CD4 cell count costs have come down. And secondly, we've trained more people in the process of how to do it. And also, as a result of improving laboratory services, because we don't want to look at CD4 cell count as an individual, but we want to look at the system, which is a laboratory system, which not only helps the CD4 cell count, but also helps to do other things which are important in the management of HIV and other infections as well. Thank you. Phil.
Yeah, it's obviously a difficult dilemma, and it's not clear what the best answer is, but I think it's very important that there be a public discussion wherever those decisions are made about how to do it, just so to make sure that the decisions are not made differently by one hospital than another. So, I mean, you have the issue of the group with the lowest CD4 counts who are individually at highest risk of death, and so, you know, in a medical ethics system, those people would get, in some systems, those people would get preference. And then the flip side is the people who are likely to survive the most. And so another argument on the other side is to give resources to people who are likely to gain the most from it. In addition to that dilemma, there's the dilemma of expanding the resource base to make sure that the growing need for antiretrovirals in this kind of situation doesn't draw funds away from prevention programs. I mean, we clearly are in a situation of limited resources and rationing, although people in America don't like to talk about rationing, but it's a situation where very difficult choices are going to have to be made, and I think it's important that all those discussions be public.
Thank you. I mean, maybe we're approaching a point at which these dilemmas argue in favor of trying to create some kind of new strategic reassessment around how to apportion responsibility and reset people's understanding of how much has been achieved, which the success stories are not as well understood, certainly, as they should be, but also to try to sort of renew a sense of commitment and momentum and around some updated vision. Tony, do you have any thoughts on how could you do that? How could you go about getting not just the major donors, but your major participating governments, your international alliances, other key institutions to really take that on?
I don't know, Steve. I just don't. But I think the way the situation is currently now, it hasn't been optimized. And as we were discussing before, it hasn't. You have countries like the United States, which are major players in it, still have not reached the relative proportion of what they likely should be doing. Mm-hmm. You have other rich countries, which I won't name because I won't get in trouble, are not really doing what they really should be doing if they want to be an active participant in the solution to these global problems. I think, as Diane alluded to and others, is that we really need to trumpet what the results have been for what we've done. And the fact, at the end of the day, one of the things I've learned in trying to ask for money for Congress is, and I go beyond Congress because you're asking a question that goes well beyond the United States, is that if you ask for money that will ultimately save money, that's a very, very good argument. I mean, if you look at the amount of money that you can save by getting people on therapy, and people have done very nice studies. And in fact, there was a couple of studies that came out. If you start people early on therapy, the health care cost of the lifetime for that person is significantly less if you wait until they get very sick. So, I mean, the problem is that argument sort of falls down when you get to the developing world where it says, well, if they die, it doesn't cost much at all. So, I mean, that's not the solution to that. So I think the idea of what parameters of success that we have been able to show and how as a global society that in fact has some very, very important impact. I mean, when I talk about globalization, I link all of this to globalization. If you really want to look at a society that's a healthy society and what it means to countries to be dealing with another country in which they're a healthy country from a trade standpoint, from an economic standpoint, from a security standpoint, there are very good reasons to keep the world as healthy as you possibly can. So it's almost people doing things for enlightened self-interest, not because they think it's a good idea. Humanitarianism, I think you forget about. That doesn't last very long. It's when people feel that they're doing something that ultimately would be in their interest. The same way companies have these broad programs in the developing world where they're treating people and diagnosing them because they want a healthy workforce. I mean, that's one of the ways to do it. I mean, a healthy workforce.
Well, America, just to speak to the opinion climate here in the United States, the Kaiser surveys and other surveys have shown a remarkable resilience of support for the investments going into global health. Which are thought to be ones that are achieving very real concrete benefits for individual humans. And there's some recent evidence that the broadened systems approach, people are willing to take that seriously as well. But I do think that there is a recurrent problem, which is telling the story effectively and to an American public. And I wanted to ask you, Diane. I mean, in where you are, as a scientist, as a professor, as a researcher, and now as an official in the International AIDS Society, how do you imagine bringing that argument to the most greatest effect in 2 years' time or today, looking forward, to an American public? Do we need to put a greater focus on the gender dimensions, on the human rights dimensions? Do we need to broaden our argument? Can we tell those stories better than we have up to now?
Well, I think that the Washington Conference is going to be a tremendous opportunity, actually the preparation for the Washington Conference, to really do this. And maybe a couple of comments. First, I don't think we can underestimate how the world looks to the U.S. in terms of leadership and how they respond to various issues. And as we were talking about before, there's a lot of disagreement in the world where nuclear arms should go or with this and that. Everyone agrees, as Tony said, health is important. And I think that we should be completely emphasizing that message as we go forward. I think the second thing that we need to do is, this is not my area of expertise, there's a little bit amount of economic scare right now. And HIV and all global health is very, very dynamic because of Tony Fauci and supporting research. Things change all the time. Maybe we don't need a T-cell count for pregnant women. Maybe we just put them on therapy. We might have cheaper diagnostics. There might be consortiums that come together for drug supply. So we've got, I'm not saying that we're not going to have to make choices, but let's be very smart about the data that we have before us when we're going in to do that. And then maybe third, and I think this is something that we should think about over the next, and this is what you're asking me. I was looking at Tony's slide with the dark ages of I'm very familiar with. And we in San Francisco, we call it HIV 1.0, 2.0. I think we're moving into 3.0. I think when we did the rollout globally, that was 2.0. So the question is, what is next? How can we get that message to the world? And it definitely needs to cross-cut over women and children, vulnerable populations, and human rights.
Thank you. Phil?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right that in the sense that the story is not well told, and it probably does need to be told in a better way. And on one hand, that's going to require better data, stronger data, outcome data that's not data that's not just modeled from computer models. And another is probably going to be some education of the public about, at least to the point that they can make their own decisions about which issues are the most important. That is, countable lives saved on one hand, or disability-adjusted life years, or extended life, time life is extended, or cost-effectiveness of interventions. So I think that the discussion needs, again, similar to what I said in the last one, I think this needs to be much more of a public discussion terms of choices that are going to be made.
Yeah, I think in my part of the world, the problem with evidence is that many people have been concentrating on the negative aspect. How many people have been turned away and that kind of thing. But there is a lot of evidence. For example, if you look at primary school teachers who are HIV infected, how many of those have been able to go back to work? And what contribution have they made subsequently to those children they are training? That information is difficult to come by because people were not targeting that. They were more interested to see people on treatment and to see people who are not on treatment. And those who are not treatment make big headlines, not the number of teachers who have went back, because people are not interested to know that. But I think with the time, and we get over the emergence of providing or scaling up antiretroviral care, people are going to now look at other aspects of evaluation and outcomes, which will inform the benefits we've had in providing care the way we've done in these few 5 years.
Why don't we invite a few comments and questions from the audience? Please come up to the microphones here. And then we'll close in a few minutes and ask for Julio Montagna to offer the wrap-up comments. Yes, Lee?
Hi. This is an excellent panel and excellent presentation. My name is Lee Yerkes. I'm an independent consultant in procurement and supply chain management. When the U.S. government first started procuring antiretroviral drugs for ART pilots in 2002, the average annual cost per patient was $600 per patient year. With the change in ART guidelines and the introduction of generic drugs, that cost came down to under $100 per patient year. However, that was a D4T-based first-line therapy. With the introduction of the tenofovir-based first-line, which is more expensive, and now with the change in CD4 treatment parameters, did the WHO consider the economic impact that would have on ART procurement or drug procurement?
You know, when you say did they consider it, I think they're aware of it. They made the recommendations, I think, just based on the scientific data of what the advantage from a pure public health standpoint would be to treat people less than 350 versus less than 200. I don't think, and I can't speak for WHO, but I think it wasn't any other motivation but to just look at what the science shows, because the data were clearly very strongly accumulating that at the earlier you treat, the better off you are. And 200 was really way off the other end of the spectrum of that. And that's, I think, what prompted the changes, not any calculation of weighing economic versus others. I don't think so. But again, I can't speak for them.
Yeah. Diane and Ellie?
One thing I might say is if that would have been considered when the 3x5 plan went into or the PEPFAR plan went into, we wouldn't even be here. So I think that's just one way to keep it in perspective. D4T is a temporizing, life-saving agent. We want people to have long and productive lives for 40 or 50 years. And so we have the data to let us know that other alternatives are better. And your points are well taken. And I think, as Tony said, they're challenges, but they're not insurmountable.
I think here the key is willingness to put people on treatment. Because once we do that, the prices are bound to come down. And that's the evidence we have on board. When we started in 2003, 2004, the costs were very high. But as soon as many people went on treatment, and drugs were produced in bulk, then the prices started to come down. And the other thing also that even the R&Ds in this country are now willing to work hand in hand with the generic companies to produce more of these drugs. And therefore, to me, I feel that shouldn't be a problem. The price will come down. All we need is to be willing and committed to provide antiretroviral therapy to our people.
Okay.
Hi, my name is Yasmin Halima. I'm the director of the Global Campaign for Microbicides, and identifying my organization might give you an idea to the question I'm likely to ask. Dr. Fauci alluded to the results of the Pro 2000 microbicide trials that came out, which were indeed disappointing, or to quote Dr. Fauci correctly, disheartening. And what I wanted to do is, I mean, for those of us who work in the field, we've spent a lot of time, day and night, trying to manage responsibly the results that came out and how the messaging went out, both to the advocate community, the scientific community, and to the press. But there's no denying that when you pick up on the responses globally, that actually there is, you know, what you might describe as a backlash. So to go refer to your opinion climate that you mentioned, in a global context, given that we have the current president of the IAS, the future president of the IAS, the governing council, and the chief executive represented in the room, it'd be a good opportunity to be able to ask the leadership of the IAS, how do you intend to respond to the challenges of continued investment in prevention research, given the challenging environment of not only the funding, but the political will? And where do you see, not only what will the IAS do, but I'm interested to know, where will you direct your efforts? Will it be, Ellie, is it a question of political challenge and governments keeping their interests sustained? Will it be at the large donors? Will it be the NIH in persuading Dr. Fauci to continue to invest in prevention research, or consolidating and making sure that the advocate community is also sustained? I'd be very interested to know.
Thank you. Which of you wishes to jump on?
I'll do, because my answer is very simple. All the above. Yeah.
You don't have to convince me to continue to invest research resources in prevention in general, and specifically in microbicides. And as I mentioned in my comment when I alluded to the Pro 2000 trial, that I am feeling more confident that we're going to enter into the arena of starting to see some results as we use specific antiretrovirals as part of a microbicide strategy, as opposed to something that ranges between a detergent and a physical blocker. Right.
Diane?
I think in science we constantly see some things work and some things don't. But I would say this is a moment for us to highlight the emphasis that needs to be put on prevention for women and empowering women, because that's the idea behind microbicides. So we have PrEP, we have microfinance approaches. We can use this moment to let people know, okay, we had one disappointment, but we really need to focus our efforts in these areas.
Thank you. Let's take two quick last comments, questions, single question, and we'll come back, close up, and then I'm going to turn to Julio Montagnat to close out. Harvey?
Harvey Sloan. I'm with the Eurasian Medical Education Program. We've been working in Russia for 5 years now, and a question that I get continually, if you guys are so good, why do you have a 3% rate in Washington, D.C.? Diane, you may want to have that addressed in the convention. And I think, Dr. Fauci, your medical interventions are just terrific. But we've got, about a fourth of the infected folks do not know it. And I know we're trying to test them, but they're not getting tested. And it seems to, and when it's, New York Times last week said that for every two people we put on therapy, five more are infected. If we don't have a massive program for behavioral change, I really don't see, I don't think we can medicalize ourselves out of this epidemic. People's behavior in this country, in this town, and abroad is very, very important for the future abatement of this disease.
I couldn't agree with you more, and I think that the together with that should be a much, much more aggressive voluntary testing program. Because you rightly pointed out, there's 1.1 million people in this country who are infected with HIV. More than 20% of them don't know that they're infected, and the majority of new infections come from the people who don't know that they're infected. So in addition to intensifying behavioral modification, you really should be having much, much more widespread testing. And I think what the situation in the district is very complex. It really is. It has I can't even begin. It'll take me 15 minutes to go over all of the complexities of the issues in the District of Columbia.
Right. Sir?
Shepard Smith, the Institute for Youth Development. We're already being told in certain sites that we can't enroll new patients in Africa by this government. And we have had cut from PEPFAR. The $63 billion global health initiative is PEPFAR money. We've had anywhere from 500 million to a billion taken out of it quite suddenly for the global health initiative, which has resulted in a dramatic turn of events for those 7.4 million people we have in care in Africa. What do you suggest we tell our patients now that we can't put on treatment? And what do we tell this government that this is pretty an unconscionable position that they've put us in?
Phil?
It's an unconscionable position, and but I just want to emphasize that it's not only people who need treatment. The numbers that Dr. Fauci showed, the proportion of people who need prevention who are getting it is even less. And a life saved by preventing an HIV infection at a year is the same, has the same value as a life saved somebody who's getting antiretroviral treatment. So it's actually it's not just a treatment focus. And it's unconscionable, but it's across the board unconscionable.
What would you tell the patients?
Ali?
The patients that you can't put on treatment?
That we've told we would.
Well, you're looking at me. I need answers from you people, because this is how our people think. In 2003, PEPFAR announced $15 billion. 5 years later, they trebled that. Isn't it?
Right.
Now, to tell my old folk that, yes, when we had $15 billion, we were able to put people on treatment. However, now that we have 50 plus, we are unable to put people on treatment. That is going to be hard to answer. And I need answers from, because I don't understand the mathematics.
Well, I think, Shepard, I think the point you're getting to is the broader point that we've been talking about here today, which is that we've gone through a period of remarkable growth and remarkable success and achievement that has saved and lifted the lives of millions of people. And how we move from that steep trajectory on an emergency basis to something that is of a different growth trajectory over a longer-term sustainable basis is not so easy. It's tricky. It's fraught with all sorts of ethical and moral choice and dilemmas, and we're in the middle of it, and we're playing catch up a little bit in terms of our own logic and debate around this. And I think this has been very healthy in terms of pushing us around where the debate is going to need to move as we get to this next phase. And I think that having a leadership like we have here, the IAS leadership and Dr. Fauci, having a leadership and having a looking forward in the next 2 years towards the Washington International AIDS Conference, the AIDS 2012, this is a great opportunity to begin thinking quite strategically about shaping a discussion around these issues, because they are not going to get easier overnight. And some of the answers are, well, the G20, I'm not sure that the G20 is going to be very easy getting the Koreans or the Indonesians or the Chinese or Indians to buy on to the notion of becoming major donors on global health. It's going to take a different kind of engagement than getting the G8 to drive the trend they have over there. And getting greater efficiencies and getting getting partner governments to put more resources forward and being innovative on financing. There's a bunch of different tools that are out there, as well as what Diane was saying, which is the picture changes and the formula changes and things that we did not think were at all possible can become possible. And so we need to sort of continue in that vein. I think we're running out of time right now, and I want to turn to Julio Montagnier to offer closing remarks. I want to thank all of our panelists this afternoon, Dr. Fauci particularly, for staying with us and for your wonderful talk. And so on behalf of everyone, please join me. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that, Stephen, and thank you to the CISS for the kind of hospitality that they have provided us at the IAS and Ron in particular. The discussion, as you can see, is fairly interesting, and clearly illustrates the nature of the problem. We have a very successful intervention or set of interventions through treatment and prevention that can drastically change the shape of the epidemic here and abroad. And yet, at the time of most need, things are not happening for us the way we would like to see it, and it's almost like we're punishing success. We were confronted with this kind of problem a number of years ago back in Canada, living in a socialized sort of medical system environment, and that pushed us in the direction of trying to start to look at the impact of our activities in a slightly different manner. And that's the truth why we became so interested on the secondary gains that derive from better treatment. And in the very few slides, I want to show you some of the experience. This is the original paper where we, in 2006, called for the case for expanding antiretroviral therapy access to curb the growth of the epidemic, at that time regarded as a bit controversial. This is based on the premise that if you shut down viral replication, you then lead to near sterilization of sexual fluids, and therefore a sharp reduction of HIV transmission should ensue. This is not to say that we're trying to substitute or medicalize prevention, but rather by treating those that need treatment, we view this as a mechanism to subtract HIV donors from the community, and if we enhance prevention, both of these strategies, as Tony indicated, should be synergistic. And we know this works because in terms of mother-to-child transmission, the evidence is overwhelming. You see it here in 1996, basically in Canada, as it is the case in North America, vertical transmission basically has been controlled through the use of a highly active antiretroviral therapy. And data is now abundant in observational studies for discordant couples, and you can read that box there on your own, but basically tells the story that in discordant couples where antiretroviral therapy has been used, transmission of HIV has been distinctly uncommon. And again, although it's possible, it's distinctly uncommon. So from a public health standpoint, this makes a lot of sense. The area where we did not have data until recently was intravenous drug users. And we had a unique opportunity to look at this data, at this issue, in a very concentrated epidemic in downtown east side of Vancouver, where basically a large number of IDUs is living in a 10-square-block radio. And in that area, the positives and the negatives are mingling all the time and sharing needles and so on and so forth. So what we did is we looked at our now more than 10-year-old HIV-positive cohort, and we characterized community viral load as a new way of looking at this particular issue. And then we superimposed on that HIV incidence from the HIV-negative IDUs in the same community. And as you can see, the two lines track together rather nicely. When we applied Cox proportional hazards to those data, we found that the plasma viral load was one order of magnitude of greater importance in terms of relative hazards, in terms of driving HIV transmission in this setting, approximately 18-fold if you consider that the plasma viral load on the first line here was 6 logs among untreated patients, versus, for example, a daily cocaine injection associated with a 2.5 relative hazard, as you see here, or use syringe sharing being associated with a relative hazard of 1.45. So what this is telling us is that now we even have data in intravenous drug user cohorts that by driving antiretroviral therapy penetration from 8% in 1996 to 98.8%, driving that community to undetectable levels, we were able to basically control HIV replication. In fact, later on this year, through a second approach at pushing antiretroviral therapy in this community, we have seen a 55-0 a decrease in HIV transmission in the downtown side among injection drug users. So rather than going through the summary notes, let me just conclude by saying all along we launched these programs very aggressively to deal with an emergency, and that's in the PEPFAR program. The emergency has not gone away, but as the programs were conceived as an emergency, neither of us really was thinking clearly about how to best monitor these programs. And we do have administrative data that indicates, as Tony demonstrated, improvements in terms of morbidity and mortality. But at the same time, we are beyond that as the key determinants of the next strategic move that is going to come out of these investments. Investing in antiretroviral therapy is, as I said, it's an investment. It's an investment because it reduces morbidity, it reduces mortality, decreases transmission, as I indicated. But not only HIV gets favorably affected. Diane mentioned this dramatic effect on decreasing tuberculosis among those who are infected and those that are not infected. But it also decreases orphanhood. And as you know, that has connotations not only for the children that are HIV infected, but also for the siblings that are not. Because in the absence of a mother, they have a 60% chance of being dead in 2 years. And we can carry on and on and on. We have failed to put this package together in a clear way, properly outlining the cost effectiveness of antiretroviral therapy as a public health intervention. And it's only now that we're in tremendous pressure by those people that are trying to look at the cost effectiveness of antiretroviral therapy only centered around the particular issue of morbidity and mortality that we feel we had to run and put our documents in order. So I think that we have the data. We know the impacts of antiretroviral therapy. We cannot have global health without rolling antiretroviral therapy more aggressively. Because if we don't, the 20% of nurses that are infected with HIV in South Africa will not be there to look after those programs. So we have to shape up, put our arguments in order, and when we do that properly, we will have an answer that ultimately is going to convince the policymakers that we need to do the right thing. And one more thing, because I'm a Canadian, I want to say thank you to the American people for the contribution you have made to the fight against HIV and AIDS. And I do realize that there is a very tense conversation going on here that Obama had promised more and didn't deliver. But let me tell you a story from the other side of the border. We haven't delivered anything. It's pathetic. And we need your help. And we need your help and Mr. Obama's help to lean on Stephen Harper to ensure that AIDS is on the G8 agenda. Because as it is, there is no AIDS in the G8 agenda. And so we realize that the conversation here about how much money America is going to put into AIDS is very important. But if we don't get your help to push the rest of the G8 leadership, including Stephen Harper, to do the right thing, this issue will not be discussed, and we will be here a year ago lamenting the missed opportunity. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Robin, could you just explain what happens now?
So cheeky coming to someone else's organisation and doing the housekeeping, isn't it? Thank you from the IS side for all of this very exciting and lively debate and all of the questions. As many of you will know, in about half an hour's time, we're going to invite all of you and others have been invited to participate in a discussion about AIDS 2012 with the two co-chairs, Diane Havlier and Eli Katibira. So those of you who are available to stay on and would like to join us will be talking about that key issue that I've heard in this discussion about how do we shape the conversation for 2012. It's 2.5 years away, but we have a remarkable opportunity now to start thinking about what we want the impact of that conference to be. We'll also be talking about the governance processes for the conference and how we can make sure that we really involve this very rich community working on HIV here in the United States. So that will be happening from 3:30 in this room, I believe. Thank you, Steve. Thank you for your welcome.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.